Hello, everybody, and welcome to the History of Actor Training in the British Drama School podcast. This is part two of a exploration we started last week, looking at the Hapgood translations of Stanislavski's books. You could go back and listen to the first one, or I think perhaps you could probably enjoy this one as a standalone podcast. If you're enjoying these podcasts, by the way, there are three ways you can support them. You can drop me a line on robertprice1869@gmail.com. It's always lovely to hear from people. You could write a review. I'd love a review. I haven't had a review for a while. So if any of you are in a supportive mood, that would be great. And the third way is to donate some cash. There's a support button on the Buzzsprout site, and I think it pops up on the bottom of the Apple feed thing, podcast doodah. Hugely appreciated. Of course, podcasts do take a little bit of money to maintain, so that's great. Thank you very much for those people who have and do donate. So, continuing our examination of the Hapgood translation, I'm going to read, before I get to Benedetti's article, I'm going to read a little bit of an article, a paper, an academic paper by Vladimir Mirodan called The First Class, Harold Lang and the Beginnings of Stanislavskian Teaching in the British Conservatoire. This is one of a small number of academic writings that consider this journey. The reason why we're doing these, I mean, actually, it's simply an important thing to consider, but also soon I'm going to start talking about Doreen Cannon in some detail, hopefully. And so we're sort of exploring what was going on in British acting training before Doreen Cannon's entrance onto the stage in the 1960s, sort of most significantly, perhaps, at the Drama Centre. I don't think I've been really sort of successfully articulating this thought. So I'm going to read Vladimir's paper because it does it very well. Because Stanislavski was both very present and very absent. Vladimir Mirodan uses this term hiding in plain sight, which of course is a familiar English turn of phrase. But I think it's rather a brilliant summary. So people read Stanislavski, they talk about Stanislavski. Schools often say that to some degree they're based on the principles of Stanislavski, but quite what they mean by that, I think, is very discussable. And the other thing is that the only text we have is the Hapgood translation, and there are all kinds of questions about that translation. So I'm just going to read the beginning of Vladimir's article. I'd highly recommend you read it. We're not really going to get to Harold Lang. But the story of Harold Lang is really interesting, and Vladimir does a really interesting thing in the paper of watching a documentary about him. Actually, is part of what he does. So anyway, I'll just read you the beginning and I'll read you the introduction. So Vladimir Mirodan writes: this article examines the groundbreaking contribution to UK actor training made by the actor and teacher Harold Lang, 1923 to 1970. Trained at RADA in the early 1940s and part of the circle of flamboyant malcontents surrounding the critic Kenneth Tynan between 1960 and 1963, Lang taught acting at the Central School of Speech and Drama, and his was the first class in a British conservatoire to be designated an acting class. Not sure about that. I mean, I've got some timetables, for instance, from the 1950, in fact, from 1950, from Rose Bruford, and Rose Bruford herself teaches acting exercises, and there's a class called acting. I mean, I don't know how specific we're being, if it's literally the words acting and class put together as acting class. But anyway, it's a persuasive thought, but I'm not sure. Anyway, Vladimir Mirodan goes on to say, a passionate Stanislavskian, Lang unusually promoted a Russian, not an American, view of Stanislavski, additionally filtered through his interest in the Central European Expressionist movement. His teaching was considered so revolutionary that it became the subject of a dedicated BBC documentary shot by the British director John Schlesinger. The article begins by mapping the landscape of British conservatoire training in the 1950s, dominated by traditional, voice-based approaches on the one hand, and an adulterated version of the improvisatory techniques of Michel Saint-Denis on the other. The article goes on to describe the exercises captured by Schlesinger's film and concludes that Lang's first acting class was instrumental in the establishment of a Stanislavskian strand in the teaching of acting in this country, thus providing a missing link between the Komisarzewski and the method generations. Stanislavski hidden in plain sight. While a student at the Central School of Speech and Drama in the 1950s, the future star Julie Christie gets into a scrap with one of her teachers. She owns up to a liking for Brecht. To get his own back, the teacher snaps, "You'll go into films anyway. You've got that sort of face." At a time and in a place where careers are still considered proper only when made in the classical theatre, Brecht is weird foreign muck and screen work in for a dig. In for a dig means beneath one, doesn't it? Sort of low. Yet Christie and her friends cannot help but sense that something exciting is crossing the channel. A new generation of British writers and directors look not only to Brecht, but also to the Italian neorealists and the French Nouvelle Vague, a new wave, that means, isn't it? And demand something different, intelligence as well as looks, an intelligent allure. Unfortunately, the famous Rank Charm School, that cross between Lee Strasberg's Actors Studio and a London finishing school for young ladies, had closed its doors almost a decade before. What is a young actor intent to carve a career other than in the classical theatre to do? I'm not actually sure, this is me, I'm not sure that the Rank Charm School, it was really more the infamous Rank Charm School. I did make a programme about it, worth having a listen to. I don't think the Rank Charm School was ever really a cross between Lee Strasberg's Actors Studio. I think it was much more a sort of a London finishing school for young starlets. And in fact, it was explicitly looking to generate starlets. So I don't think the Rank Charm School, despite the some serious teachers, was really a very serious institution. I'm sure Vladimir Mirodin knows that. But anyway, he says. And then, even in the theatre, new writing demands new ways of acting. Trying to keep up with the times, in autumn 1956, Central recruits James Roose Evans, one of the Young Turks of British directing, to direct Angus Wilson's The Mulberry Bush. He encourages his cast, which includes a young Vanessa Redgrave, to improvise, analyse and discuss their characters. Redgrave is thrilled to be invited, along with the rest of the cast, to have dinner in Roose Evans' flat in character. The problem is that neither she nor her colleagues are quite sure how to go about this way of working. Redgrave is luckier than most. Her father, one of the greats of the British stage, had read Stanislavski and is a fervent adherent. Maybe, this is me, maybe we'll read a bit of Michael Redgrave's thoughts about acting. He wrote a very fine book on acting, so perhaps we can do that at some point. Anyway. Vladimir Mirodin goes on to say, but when Vanessa finds an actor prepares on her father's bookshelves, gulps it down overnight and brings it to class the next morning shouting, "It's all here, it's all here," some students look amused, others bored, or as if their infinite tolerance was strained to the limit. The paper is quoting an autobiography of Vanessa Redgrave here. The teacher's reaction is equally cool. They have, of course, read the works of this Russian actor, and he is interesting as far as it goes. But his is only one approach amongst many, and, in the end, it's horses for courses. The greatness of a British drama school resides precisely in its generous heterodoxy. Redgrave writes, "It was my first encounter with ingrained English eclecticism, and I was astonished and maddened by it. I little realised then that this open-minded acceptance of the equal validity of all methods concealed a real hostility to any method in particular, and especially to such a method as Stanislavski's, which based itself upon objective processes in nature and society." Stanislavski is hidden in plain sight. Brilliant, really brilliant summary. I mean, there are things that one might argue with, including Vanessa Redgrave's assertion, which of course is Stanislavski's himself, which is that it's based on objective processes in nature and society. I think that would be contestable. But anyway, Stanislavski is hidden in plain sight. Other students of the time also aspire, in an inchoate way, towards something more coherent, more consistent, more purposeful, more systematic. There is, however, no such thing in any British drama school as an acting class that might give one a compass with which to go in search of this elusive something. The closest thing acting programmes from London to Bristol to Glasgow have to offer is something variously called mime or technique. At Central, Oliver Reynolds and Walter Hudd teach mime, not of the white-faced variety, but a class in relaxation and being private, in public, without words or props. Judy Dench recalls being asked to walk in a familiar garden. Years later, her classmate, the future acting teacher Charles Lewson, could still summon the image of a girl wandering in a garden, sitting for a moment on a swing, and then departing. Simple. Unemphatic, the work of someone who could already achieve repose in the presence of an audience and who probably had the capacity to live fully in the present. Beautiful. I mean, still definitely needed for an actor. At the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, Michael McCowan, the principal, similarly starts his course with simple silent mimes. Vladimir Muradin puts them in inverted commas, designed to express spontaneous reactions to a thought or situation and to develop the creative imagination. At the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, Mary Phillips runs, under the label MIME, wordless classes that develop the student's ability to tell a story by physical means. Asked to depict a soldier parting from his wife on the way to the front, the actor Kenneth Cranham, who you can still see occasionally in the West End, and his partner gain high praise for suggesting the motion of the departing train by moving their feet in opposite directions. I think there are quite a lot of roots into this sort of mime into the British drama school, some of which come from the very beginning and perhaps in the work of François Delsarte, I think is how you pronounce his name. And then, yes, we have Saint-Denis' introduction of the exercises, I think principally of Suzanne Bing. And then there are other influences too. I think Central has a sort of a homegrown tradition of mime, which I'm hoping at some point to make a podcast about. Anyway, Vladimir Muradin goes on to say, but the most telling from our perspective is the technique class run at RADA from 1955 to 1963 by the actor Peter Barkworth. I saw Peter Barkworth in the 80s in a thing about Siegfried Sassoon. Beautiful. One-man show. I think it was called something to do with a fox, the memoirs of a fox-hunting man. Anyway, he was a wonderful actor. In his two-hour classes per week, Barkworth teaches entrance and exits, drinking, smoking, and eating on stage, moves towards and away from a partner, blocking, and business with props. You have a mug of hot tea, and you must place it on your head during your speech in a believable way. Alongside these essentially choreographic exercises, Barkworth also introduces concepts relating to motivation and character relationships. In so doing, he assimilates into his teaching certain Stanislavskian principles, notably intentions and inner obstacles. Barkworth calls these cover-ups, as in, I'm shy, but I'll be damned if I'll show it. The old Russian is acknowledged, certainly, but his ideas and techniques are cited in the same breath as Wendy Hiller on walks or Edith Evans on not taking pauses. Barkworth is a pragmatic teacher who has adopted Stanislavski without turning his ideas into dogma, the quintessential English approach, also extolled by his contemporaries at Central. Gwyneth Thurban, long-serving principal at the latter, is fond of quoting Orson Welles. The only thing wrong with the method is the word the. Peter Barkworth wrote a couple of books, actually, in which his acting classes are written down. They're kind of wonderful books, and they're still in print, I think, about acting, and more about acting. And I've heard Peter Barkworth talk about his time teaching at RADA from 1955 to 1963. Touchingly, he always talks about how much he loved it, his happiest days. He loved teaching. And anyway, I think Vladimir Mirodan's description is fair. Ultimately, mime and technique are there to reveal the presence of intuition. Dench herself recalls that she had actually forgotten she was supposed to prepare the garden exercise, so she had to do it off the cuff. It was the very fact that she was able to respond spontaneously to an unexpected situation that convinced her she had the talent to become an actor, to improvise. As to character, I don't know whether you heard Michael Balogun's podcast, but he talks about how in some ways actors are quite like criminals because they're both peoples who need to think on their feet to improvise. I mean, Michael might like that description of Judi Dench making it up. As to character, whether one starts with a pair of shoes, with the tempo of a speech in verse, or with decisions about covering up, the effect is meant to be the same. To find ways of identifying, by which is meant of assimilating the experiences of the character with one's own. The famous voice teacher Kate Fleming, who teaches at RADA and Webber Douglas before becoming Olivier's head of voice at the newly formed National Theatre, talks to her students about finding the essential core of the character. Once they had located certain traits in themselves, everything else would fall in its place of its own accord. The real challenge is not to create a character, but to summon the courage to confess in public. Stanislavskian concepts such as action, objectives, or psychophysical transformation are generally shunned, as they are deemed to be intellectual analytical, and thus inimical to intuition. For these teachers, who in comparison with the pre-war generation actually consider themselves to be innovators, improvisation alone is the wrench with which to prise open the floodgates behind which the creative waters of the British theatre stagnate. Nice writing. This is not the place to chart the evolution of improvisation classes in the British Conservatoire, beyond pointing out that much of which is being taught in mime classes is an adulterated form of the exercises imported from France by Michel Saint-Denis, taught by him on either side of World War II at his two London schools and disseminated by his erstwhile pupils, and colleagues, I think, many of whom find themselves by the late 1950s in positions of influence. Yet even this kind of improvisation remains confined. Ever restless and well informed by her family connections, Vanessa Redgrave misses the full panoply of Saint-Denis' exercises. Animal, mime, clown, masks, she complains. The mime classes were still of the old school. Pretend you have a teacup and saucer in your hand. 4 years earlier, the Young Vic Theatre School had been closed down. The Arts Council drama director, Evelyn Rees, was hostile to the work he saw the students were involved in. "I went into a class of Saint-Denis," said Rees, "and these boys and girls were all being animals. It was like going into a lunatic asylum. When Michel Saint-Denis took my father round the school for the last time, he was crying." Well, that's cool. I wonder if anyone else has written that down. So Michel Saint-Denis takes Michael Redgrave around the school. No single glimpse or reverberation of this kind of work and these great cultural achievements existed in the training of the central school, stuck in the depths of English middle-class philistinism. Strong words. At around the same time, on the other side of the tracks, a few oddballs began flirting with the method. In 1963, the stage newspaper carries ad for the somewhat unfortunately named SM School of Method Drama, and for the Actors' Workshop, London's oldest method studio. In 1956, the BBC even sends a crew to film for its Tonight programme the goings-on at the Method School in Dean Street. Wednesday evenings, a fiver for the term. Run by one Jos Tregoningo, the self-styled Lee Strasberg of London, a diminutive man sporting a D'Artagnan-type moustache and beard. There, the TV reporter comes across George, one of the more advanced students, who is portraying, what else? A tree. In the midst of being a rather wonderful tree, George is asked by the BBC presenter how he feels, at which point George utters the immortal line, I can feel the sap rising in me. Redgave and Christie are not alone in their frustrations. George Devine organises a high-profile roundtable at the Royal Court, during which Peter Brook, Michel Saint-Denis, the actor Kenneth Haig, and the critic Charles Marowitz, might talk about Charles Marowitz at some point. I think he's a bit more than the critic. I think Charles Marowitz also taught method acting in London at the time that Vladimir Mirodan is writing about. And I've also got this the transcript of this conversation between George Devine, Peter Brook, Michel Saint-Denis, Kenneth Haig, and Marowitz. Anyway, they ventilate the challenges of introducing Stanislavskian thinking into British theatre practice. The foundations of the British conservatoire training are drying up, and wide cracks are beginning to open in its walls. It is at the gates of this exposed edifice that in 1960, the actor Harold Lang, a passionate, evangelical Stanislavskian, arrives riding his bicycle. The story is about to lead ultimately to the founding of the Drama Centre. Lang, I believe, never actually teaches at the Drama Centre. He does other things, and the person who fills the space that he was probably expected to fill is Doreen Cannon. So in a way, this is the sort of the pre-Doreen Cannon story. But anyway, I think that's a really wonderful piece of writing from Vladimir Mirodan, sort of summing up what Britain was like. Returning now to Jean Benedetti's paper, so at least now we can understand more, in more detail, what the Stanislavski that someone like Vanessa Redgrave was reading. And there are some important questions about that translation. So, yes, returning to Jean Benedetti. So we were about halfway through, we'd got to this bit, which says death and its consequences. In 1937, so this is the time of the publication of the first edition of An Actor Prepares, known, I think, in Russian as An Actor's Work on Himself. In 1937, despite the recent death of her husband, Mrs. Hapgood, this is the translator, travelled to Moscow, where she stayed for 10 days in an effort to complete work on An Actor's Work on Himself 2, Physical Characterization, Building a Character, so that publication should not be too long delayed. She worked with Stanislavski every afternoon, and in the evening consulted his colleagues. She returned home empty-handed, but with a promise that the manuscript would be sent to her as soon as it was ready. In August 1938, Stanislavski died. 4 months later, his son Igor, who was living in Rabat at the time, reaffirmed on the 22nd of January 1939, before a notary, Leon Cochard, the agreement his father had signed in April 1930 on behalf of himself and his daughter. This affirmation was ratified the following day by a judge. It became his responsibility to forward the draft of Building a Character to Mrs. Hapgood. The invasion of the Soviet Union by Nazi Germany severed all communications, and was not until 1947 that Igor was able to send the material for Building a Character to New York. It's stormy, isn't it? Norman Hapgood dies, Stanislavski dies, and the Germans invade the Soviet Union, all of which interferes with this process. It was no more than material, since Stanislavski had nowhere near completed work on the book. Elizabeth Hapgood only received, and possibly she could not know this, a selection of the innumerable variants of almost every passage which are now lodged in the Stanislavski archives. I think, just to be very, this is me, to be very simple, I think An Actor Prepares Part 1 is about actor training, and the later books are about rehearsal. So breaking them in this way, I think, is pretty significant. So the British Drama School establishment, for instance, has read the first part, but has no real idea about the second. And this is years are passing. As usual, she cut and reworked the material. Publication had been fixed for 1948, the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Moscow Art Theatre. but was postponed to the following year because Igor had provided additional material. There was thus a 14-year gap between the publication of An Actor Prepares and Building a Character, and it was already too late to establish in the popular and the professional mind the notion of a unitary psychophysiological technique. So this, I think, is part of Benedetti's thesis, that this separation of the two parts of what is actually a single book sort of fixes in people's minds something which is fundamentally flawed in terms of an understanding. Other people have written about this since. I think it's how I felt about it too. I think I was really surprised, it's hard to remember, but when I first read that Stanislavski said things about language and about words, he says lots, because I think that I'd picked up on this curious sort of split as a young person, maybe even before I was an actor, and associated, of course, which I think people do less now, Stanislavski fully with the American method. Back to the paper. Still convinced that she was serving the best interests of Stanislavski's family, in 1948 Mrs. Hapgood negotiated the transfer of the copyright of My Life in Art to herself. In 1961 she published Creating a Role, her version of the book, which had appeared in the Soviet Union in 1957 as the work of an actor on a role. Subsequently she published two books of extracts, Stanislavski's Legacy and An Actor's Handbook. Theatre people in the English-speaking world believed that they held Stanislavski's authentic texts in their hands, texts which were a precious source of wisdom, which would enable them to advance in the perfection of their art. Specialists quickly displayed considerable more scepticism. So nice that we heard Vladimir Mirodam writing about Vanessa Redgrave going, "It's all here." Benedetti's not quite so sure. This next section is called, chapter, The Legacy of Doubt. The publication in 1938 in the Soviet Union of an actor's work on himself provided an opportunity to compare the English and Russian texts. The English version immediately came under severe criticism, mainly because of the cuts. The removal of numerous passages distorted, it was claimed, the logical exposition of the system. The translation of certain key words was also questioned. A number of critics concluded that the two books were not the same. Further protests were heard when the books reappeared in Volume 2 of the complete works in 1954 with an appendix containing revisions and supplementary passages Stanislavski would have included had he been able to rework the text. But even more worrying was the considerable disparity between Building a Character and An Actor's Work on Himself 2, Physical Characterization, published in 1955 as Volume 3 of the complete works. This time, it was Stanislavski himself who was responsible for the problem. Shortly after Elizabeth Hapgood's departure for the US in 1937, an exhausted Stanislavski, now extremely ill, gave up all efforts to finish An Actor's Work too, and confided his manuscripts to his pupil, Georgi Christie, with a request that he put them in order and sort out some kind of text from the mass of notes. Christie took those chapters which were more or less complete, diction and its laws, characters and types and tempo rhythm, and he himself reconstructed the rest. Thus, while the Soviet edition has more or less the same chapter heads as the English edition, the two texts are often totally different. The Soviet edition once again provided the additional material, notably on diction, which Stanislavski wanted to include in the chapters he himself had completed. Given the 14-year gap which separated the publication of An Actor Prepares and Building a Character, it would have seemed of paramount importance to stress the interconnection between the two, their status as two parts of a whole. That Stanislavski never ceased to regard An Actor's Work on Himself as one work, and its appearance in two volumes as a regrettable necessity, is evident from the list of chapter heads he drafted in 1935. Part 1 at that time contained only 14 chapters, and the chapters for Part 2 are expressly numbered from 15 onwards, so he sees it as a single book. In her preface to Building a Character, Mrs. Hapgood is, however, curiously ambiguous. She gives the impression that she was unaware during her time with Stanislavski in Menton and Bardenweiler that he had planned a single book. She learned of the existence of this second volume, she tells us, from letters and from her visit to Moscow in 1937. At one point, she refers to building a character as a sequel, and on the following page it becomes a continuation. Nowhere is it seen as integral to a total process. The title, Building a Character, moreover, suggests no necessary connection with an actor prepares, and is also seriously misleading. What Stanislavski spoke of was a, I don't know this word, a voploskini, or incarnation, the process by which an imaginative experience is given concrete physical form, shaped by the actor's skills of voice and body. A character is not built, but is an image made flesh. Stanislavski's full title is an actor's work on himself in the creative process of incarnation. Just how serious the confusion Mrs. Hapgood's title provokes is clearly evident in Peter Brook's book, The Shifting Point. Although most actors understand that preparation is not construction, yet even in the title of Stanislavski's great work, Building a Character, this misunderstanding persists, implying that a character can be built up like a wall until one day the last brick is laid and the character is complete. To my mind, it is the opposite. I would say that the process consists not of two stages, but of two phases. First, preparation. Second, birth. This is very different. In later chapters, he makes further reference to actors who think they're using the Stanislavski system by assembling a character rather than preparing for that intuitive leap which is the prime purpose of Stanislavski's method. Brook is nearer to Stanislavski than he imagines. The failure adequately to present an integrated psychophysical technique resulted all too frequently in an imbalance in training. An Actor Prepares became the book, while Building a Character seemed like a less important afterthought. The supposed supremacy of inner motivation, of feeling it, led several generations of young actors to reject or neglect the rigorous development of vocal and physical skills. Students and tutors alike appeared unaware that before beginning to develop his psychotechnique at the age of 43, Stanislavski was already recognised at home and abroad as an actor of consummate technical skill. Saint-Denis talks about seeing Stanislavski in a huge theatre and how he and the other Russian actors had incredible technique. An Actor's Work on a Role, which completes Stanislavski's study of the actor's training, was published in 1957 as Volume 4 of the Complete Works, a collection of texts written in 1916-20, 30-33 and 1934. It amounts to no more than an indication of a book which Stanislavski had described to his secretary Ripsey in December 1930, and which would have formed part of a sequence of seven. The American edition of 1961, Creating a Role, corresponds more or less to the Russian edition, although once more cut, with passages transposed. It does, however, give the quite false impression of a completed book on a par with An Actor Prepares, whereas the Soviet edition states quite clearly that it is material towards a book. Recent editions in Germany emphasise the provisional nature of the published text even more clearly. Given the ever more vociferous protests over the years against the differences between the English and Russian texts, the final volume of The Complete Works appeared in 1961. What would have been more logical than to modify Mrs. Hapgood's versions or to bring out new translations based on the Soviet edition? Logic, unfortunately, has little part to play in subsequent events. The management of theatre arts books reacted angrily to the slightest breath of criticism of the Hapgood translations. Since it was evident that some response was required, it engaged a specialist to make a line-by-line comparison of the English and Russian texts of An Actor Prepares. This resulted in a notarized statement which affirmed that, apart from the removal of repetitions and redundancies, the two texts were identical. This statement often referred to, has apparently disappeared from the Theatre Arts Books archives. Anyone, moreover, who wishes to consult Stanislavski's original manuscript, which is lodged in the New York City Library, and may well bear Mrs. Hapgood's own annotations, will discover that special permission is required before access can be allowed. Does that mean that John Benedetti wasn't allowed to look? As to the question of Mrs. Hapgood's use of terminology, the response of Theatre Arts Books was simple. She had consulted experienced professionals concerning usage. More recent studies, however, have both demonstrated the inconsistencies and confusions in the translation of basic terms and revealed the distortions produced by injudicious cuts. I've mentioned Sharon Carnicki's work on this area in the earlier podcast, but worth mentioning that this excellent paper by Jean Benedetti has a sort of an equivalent in a book by Sharon Carnicki, which is fantastic. Sharon Carnicki's book is called Stanislavski in Focus. Well worth reading if you're interested in this kind of thing. Thus, Mrs. Hapgood fails adequately to distinguish and consistently to translate terms such as to behave, to do, and to act. I don't speak Russian, but these words are действовать, which is to behave, to do, делать, and to act, играть, which for Stanislavski have distinct meanings. It is indeed critical for a full understanding of the system for these terms to be kept rigorously separate, and it is an unfortunate fact that in English all three verbs may be translated in different contexts by act, as in, I don't like the way he acts, meaning to behave, he must act, do something, or I want him to act, play, perform. Mrs. Hapgood, having no direct knowledge of the system in action, fails to maintain these essential distinctions. She also fails to maintain the equally crucial distinction between the objective, zadachka, and the action taken to achieve that objective, действие. Objections to the divergences between, I think zadachka can be translated as task. I think that's what Benedetti does later. Objections to the divergences between building a character and an actor's work on himself have been countered with arguments of a more political nature. Having acquainted herself with George Christie's text, Mrs. Hapgood came to the conclusion that Stanislavski was the victim of ideological manipulation. It is necessary to remember the Cold War atmosphere of the period. The problem was the importance given to action over psychological stage, which seemed to her a clear indication that the system had been deliberately reshaped to bring it more into line with the principles of socialist realism and to fit the party line which condemned psychologism. It is true, as we are now aware, that Christie excluded some materials from his edition for ideological reasons. But the new emphasis on action prefigured in Stanislavski's work even as far back as 1904-1905. It's not his invention, as is confirmed by the verbatim records of Stanislavski's rehearsals and classes of the period, and in Vasily Torpukov's book, Stanislavski in Rehearsal. If any of you are listening and you haven't, and you're interested in this stuff and you haven't read Torpukov's book, Stanislavski in Rehearsal, I'd highly recommend it. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful read. Mrs. Hapgood's 10-day visit to Moscow in 1937 had not given her a real opportunity to come to grips with the new method of physical action, which was known only to a few people in Stanislavski's immediate circle, although she might have learned it from Stella Adler, who had worked with Stanislavski in Paris in 1934 and had created a furore on her return to New York by telling Lee Strasberg that he was out of date. Mrs. Hapgood's view of the system was conditioned both by the émigrés she consulted, such as Boleslavsky and Uspenskaya, who'd left Russia just after the revolution, having worked with Stanislavski at a time when much greater emphasis was placed on psychological analysis and emotional memory, and by current versions of the system, such as the much-publicised method. Had she understood the new approach, she would certainly not have cut two crucial pages at the beginning of the third section of Creating a Role, where Stanislavski clearly indicates the break with an earlier approach, with its emphasis on preliminary discussion and research into the subtext, and the transition to an approach where analysis through action comes first. The subtext is in the action. She does not seem to have understood that the texts which were gathered together to form the book chart very clearly the historic evolution of the system as a rehearsal method. Her opposition to the Soviet text was based on misunderstanding. This is, the method of physical actions, and also active analysis is being described here. She cuts it because she thinks it's ideological. It's to do with Soviet ideas about what's a good, in a socialist sense, art. The next chapter or bit is called The Hapgood Myth. In 1964, Mrs. Hapgood applied for a renewal of copyright, not only in an act of repairs, but also in building a character and creating a role, still as co-author. Her application was granted. In the meantime, she received letters from the Alexeyev family confirming her power of attorney. That's Igor's family, I think, isn't it? That's Stanislavski's son. She thus had complete control of Stanislavski's works outside the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc. In consequence, translations into other languages in the West are taken from the Hapgood versions, not from the Soviet complete works, suffer the same cuts and incorporate the same errors. So this is the story of the books in many languages, not all languages, but many, many languages. Again, I didn't realise that. After the publication of the complete works, 1954 to 1961, there seemed to be some hope that an unsatisfactory situation might be resolved. The Soviet Union had still not signed the Berne Convention. The books were therefore not in copyright. It should have been possible to commission a new translation from the Russian text and thus break the Hapgood stranglehold. The Italian publisher, La Terza, attempted to bring out such a new version. The Hapgood estate immediately went to court pour encourager les autres and won. However, the court's ruling was to say the least tantalising. It would be possible to produce new translations, providing suitable fees were paid to the Hapgood estate. But publishers hesitated to enter the legal lion's den. They continued to reprint or translate the English texts. Only an illegal edition in Argentina slipped through the net. The passage of years saw the creation of a Hapgood myth. Her friendship with Stanislavski was seen as unique, a sublime example of elective affinities. Their meeting became historic, opening the path to a collaboration of an exceptional kind. Of critical importance was the fact that Stanislavski had given her carte blanche to cut and adapt his works for the American reader. In her preface to Creating a Role, she states, "I believe that in preparing these three texts, I have carried out once more the task entrusted to me by Stanislavski himself, to eliminate duplications and cut whatever was meaningless for non-Russian actors." Stanislavski's letters of thanks are also adduced as evidence of this unique relationship. The title co-author, originally intended as a legal device, was also transformed into a weapon in the armory of theatre arts books. If Elizabeth Hapgood is not merely Stanislavski's collaborator, but also co-author, how is it possible to question the decisions she took? Her versions are thus endowed with an authority which they do not merit. Benedetti's getting quite intense here. The fact that Stanislavski gave carte blanche to all his collaborators, Kuransky, Gurevich, Christie, seems to have been forgotten. Stanislavski wrote many glowing letters of thanks to Mrs. Gurevich and recognised her contribution in the preface to the second Soviet edition of My Life in Art. He was the most courteous of men, often paying elaborate compliments to those to whom he felt in debt. Mrs. Gurevich appears to have taken such letters for what they were, acts of politeness. The over-defensive attitude of theatre arts books and the idealisation of Mrs. Hapgood's role have not served her well. In attempting to establish authoritative texts and to make clear what Stanislavski actually intended, not admittedly always easy, specialists have been forced into increasing conflict with her and obliged to concentrate their attention on the deficiencies of her texts. As a result, her genuine contribution in bringing knowledge of Stanislavski to the West has been lost sight of in the dust of battle. Without her persistence and dedication, An Actor Prepares would probably never have appeared as a completed book in any language. She did create the terminology which is in general use. It is in some ways unsatisfactory, but anyone who's grappled with the difficulties of finding new expressions will know just how intractable the problem can be. Nor was she at any time motivated by personal gain. Given the discouraging attitudes of publishers in the 30s, she could scarcely have anticipated that the books would subsequently be such a continual commercial success. She did not, in fact, claim any royalties until 1957, and there appears to be no evidence that she ever recouped the money she originally spent as underwriting, even though Stanislavski frequently pressed her to do so. The legal arrangements she made were made in good faith, and she could justifiably claim that she had protected the interests of Stanislavski's heirs as he had requested. It's an unfortunate irony that legal probity and a strong sense of duty should result in the perpetuation of artistic and conceptual confusion. Having acknowledged Mrs. Hapgood's justifiable claim to our gratitude, we must also acknowledge that editorial decisions made in 1936 or even 1961, in order to make the books commercially viable for a readership with little knowledge of the technicalities of training, cannot, in Stanislavski's interest and in the interest of those studying to be actors, be allowed to stand. The reading public of the late 80s and 90s is a very different proposition. The proliferation of theatre and drama courses in universities, polytechnics and colleges, conservatoires and theatre schools at both undergraduate and graduate level has produced a readership which demands full access to Stanislavski's writings in all their richness, contradiction and confusion. Decisions made under commercial pressures by people who were neither trained in nor ever practiced the system, particularly in its later form, are no longer valid. Nor are specialists only concerned. The general public, too, thanks to the mass media, to workshops and open discussions, is accustomed to witness analysis of the actor's craft, pursued in much greater depth than heretofore. Heretofore is a lovely word. And the Soviet Union is no longer, in Churchill's words, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Audiences now see Russian acting. A response to changed historical circumstances is needed. The current situation may be accounted dramatic. It risks becoming a farce. A new 12-volume complete works is beginning to appear in the Soviet Union, which is based on recent scholarship, restores cuts made in the earlier edition, and incorporates new material made available from the archives. Until some way is found to resolve the legal difficulties and release these new texts in adequate translations, students and teachers in the West will be obliged to go on studying material which they know to be defective. So, thank you very much for listening. I really enjoyed reading that. I hope some of you enjoyed it too. Jean Benedetti, of course, goes on to publish a contemporary translation of An Actor Prepares and Building a Character as an Actor's Work. That was published in 2008 with an introduction by Declan Donlan, of course. Well worth a read. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Take care. I hope you're having a good summer. And talk to you soon. Bye.